This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, Episode 8 for Thursday, May 21st, 2009. That's not my cup of cafe. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Welcome to another edition of Out of Line After Hours. We have a whole bunch to talk about. I know we say that at the top of every show, but I got to introduce everybody who's here tonight, starting with Jason Vines, who just took the red eye in from L.A. to be here. Jason, great having you here.
What a night it could be.
And, of course, Peter DeLorenzo. Peter, great having you back here. And I thought you did a great job with last week's show.
Thanks. You make it look easy, John.
I know. Well, we're going to have to rotate because I thought you came alive as being the host. I thought it was pretty good. And then we've got Sam Abulsamid from Autoblog joining us tonight. So, Sam, great having you here, man.
Pleasure to join you gentlemen this evening.
Yeah, so there's so much to talk about. But one thing that I threw out as a conversation starter was, is the Chevrolet Volt going to be built? Really? Is it really going to go into production? And I know you had a chance to drive one of the mules that they got. Tell us a bit about driving that, Sam.
Well, the mules we drove were in the Cruise bodies. They're the second-generation mules. And basically, it behaves pretty much like you would expect a normal car, and it behaves like anybody who's ever driven an electric vehicle would be familiar with it because it's quiet, in fact, quieter than most EVs because they've done a lot of work on the motor to keep the hum and the whine from the motor down. And it just behaved very normally, very uneventful, which, is a good thing because for what's supposed to be a really mainstream car, I mean, they're trying to appeal to the masses with this thing, even though the price is going to be high. The intent ultimately is to be a mass-produced car. It's got to behave the way people expect a car to behave.
Every review that I've read so far says the acceleration is impressive in it.
Yeah, well, most EVs are. I mean, because electric motors produce a lot of torque down low.
I've driven some EVs that are mighty slow.
Well, yeah, I mean, you talk about some of these, neighborhood electric vehicles, that, have about 10 horsepower. They're basically glorified golf carts. They're slow, but most of the higher-powered EVs that are designed for, all-around use tend to be reasonably quick.
But did this have the engine in it, the gasoline engine?
It had the engine in it, but it wasn't turned on for our drive. They're still working on the calibration of the transition when it comes on and off to get that as smooth as they can.
I've heard that's a problem. That when it comes on, like if you're going 70 miles an hour down the freeway, boom, comes on at like 4,000 RPM.
Yeah, it's so quiet when it's running in EV mode that, you've got to really work at it to make that startup quiet and smooth. They've promised us that they'd let us drive that within the next couple of months, probably right after they get the first actual Volt-bodied prototypes done, which is supposed to start happening in the next couple of weeks.
The car should throw off a flare just before it's go, what's that to you?
But here's my question. They're not going to make money on this car.
Certainly not for the first couple of years. Probably the first 3 or 4 years, I wouldn't expect, because the volumes are going to be pretty low at first as they ramp up and get experience with those batteries. I'm sure they don't want to put out too many of them at first, until they see how the batteries perform in the real world, because, it's all new battery technology. And they're going to lose a ton of money on them at first.
That's my question. I talked to a very knowledgeable, on their show we'll say anything, right? But I'm not going to say this person's name. But it's a Wall Street type who assured me that car will never be built because of that very reason. They're going to lose a bunch of money on it. And here's a company that can't afford to bring out cars that they're going to lose a bunch of money on.
All of these companies have lost money on certain products just to stay in the market. Look at the Toyota Prius. They lost money for the first 4 years. And it's a question whether they're making money now.
They're not in bankruptcy and getting government money and all that.
This is such a big ticket item as far as image. There is no way they won't make it. Whoever's your contact, when the car comes out, then you go back and you bring them on the show.
Yeah.
And we laugh at them.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that, GM is almost assuredly going to go into Chapter 11 in a couple of weeks.
And no, 1 week.
Okay, week and a half, 1 week, whatever. They're going to go into Chapter 11 in the coming days. And the government is more than likely going to take a majority shareholding of the company. And given what was announced this week with their policies on CO2 emission standards, adopting the California standards, I can't see the government allowing them to not build the Volt.
If GM is still alive, the Volt will be built.
Here's another question, though, Peter. And believe me, I think the Volt's a cool car. I want to buy one of these things. I'm not trying to trash it, but I think these are good issues to raise. As we know, they were going to build a new engine plant to build that four-cylinder engine for the Volt. It was going to go in Flint, Michigan, until they reached in their pockets and they realized they didn't have a couple of $100 million to build a new engine plant. And so they decided, well, no problem, we'll just import it from Opel. Well, hello, Opel may not be part of General Motors by the time this thing's supposed to get ready. I'm sure whoever ends up with Opel would say, no problem, GM, we need the volume, we'll build those engines for you. But guess what? The price of whatever GM was going to buy those engines for from Opel, you know, internal transfer price, that thing just got jacked up way time. And so there's another hurdle. If you thought that the Volt was going to lose money, you know, before any of this started, I think the cost of that four-cylinder engine just went up more.
No, well, the Volt's not going to make a dime.
But you don't have to.
Yeah, no, but that's not why they're doing it. I mean, if they're going to be in existence, they have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
there's no way they'll get around it.
No Volt, no GM.
No GM, yeah. Okay. Speaking of the Volt, Bob Lutz was on David Letterman last night. What'd you make of his appearance?
Do we have a little clip?
Yeah. Don't we have a clip of that? Let's run that.
The way you create shareholder value is to produce vehicles that people want. And at $2 a gallon, you couldn't give small cars away in the United States. And this fiction, well, Detroit insisted on building these large cars for too long, where the American public wanted small, highly fuel-efficient vehicles. That happened for 4 months during 2008 when gasoline was over $4 a gallon. Now everybody wants crossovers and trucks again. So we cannot... This idea of the government mandating strict fuel economy standards at the same time that we have the world's cheapest gasoline is like combating national right. obesity by forcing clothing manufacturers to make only small sizes. You know,
he's right.
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, I blasted Letterman for the whole Elon Musk thing. You know, he spouted off so many half-truths and untruths the week before. I applaud Letterman for bringing Lutz on. And he was on. I mean, it was half hour, 25 minutes.
Lutz was on that long?
Yeah, he was. I was, like, shocked. And so I thought, all in all, Lutz did a good job. But I'll tell you what, I know Bob pretty well, and I thought that was the most nervous I have ever
really?
Seen.
Really?
Yeah, he was nervous.
Huh.
It's a different stage, but God, I look at the clip now because I was on a plane.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He looks younger than Letterman.
I was going to say.
And,
real
and
good.
With the black shirt, he looks like he was making an appearance later on The Sopranos.
Could be.
Sadly.
Yeah. No, you're right. But what's the guy now? 77 years old?
Yeah. He's I'm sorry.
Well, Letterman's up into his 60s, too. So.
Yeah, but that's a difference. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He's a stud. I don't love him or hate Bob Lutz. He's a stud.
Yeah.
And a Marine. And Swiss.
Right.
All right.
So, yeah, kudos to Bob for getting Letterman to admit how wrong he was with what he had said about the Volt before. In fact, I think he confessed to being ignorant about it.
Yeah, there was a tone of, a conciliatory tone, definitely, from Letterman and trying to, you know, make a big point about Detroit and letting Lutz talk about the industry and how we got to this point.
So. That's what they need to do, though. That's what GM needs to do. Keep talking. Not this bunker mentality.
Well, we talked about that. Lutz should have been in Washington, but let's not go there again.
Yeah, we don't have
We're
to
not
go
talk
that,
about Washington.
Well, actually, you know, Bob can also be a bit of a loose cannon, too. So,
sending
him to Washington, you know, could
No, they needed
backfire.
A loose cannon in Washington
right.
because the soundbite takeaway was horrible. Right. They needed Lutz pounding on the desk and pointing at those guys, saying, you're going to listen to what I have to say. Because, yeah, he's a loose cannon at times, but, boy, anything would have been better than what they ended up with in December.
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
That was a disaster.
But, you know, one thing about last night is, you know, at the end, Letterman, you know, ended up asking Lutz if he could buy the first production Volt.
Oh, yeah, that was funny. Yeah,
Bob told him, well, you're going to have to get in line. Yeah,
people were giving the first one to.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, he did, and Letterman said, yeah, but they don't have you on their talk show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. That's good.
Jason, what do you make of this new cafe ruling?
Wow, what a day. As I actually did reader mail on Peter's site today, it is awesome that we have a national standard, finally. You know, I was part of the lobbying group when the 13 states in the Northeast were trying to adopt California, and it's just a nightmare. That's great. It's scary. These are scary numbers. I hope they can make it. The administration had the automakers by the proverbial balls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're the owners.
They were all smiling.
They're all smiling.
And I'm thinking behind those smiles, these guys aren't smiling.
You said it on your site. This is Kevin Bacon in Animal House saying, thank you, sir. Can I have another?
Yeah.
So they had to take it. They're all in the same playing field. Now, the end of the day, by 2016, being green doesn't matter because everybody has to be green, right? I hope they can make it. I hope that the pricing is there. It's always scary when you mandate a product, but you don't mandate demand. That's scary because we are a market-based economy. Now, if we are going to a full socialist country, fine. I guess we'll be okay if we're full socialism and the government dictates what we sell and what we buy. My contention is, and I wrote it on Peter's site, this is not going to stop our dependency on foreign oil.
Right. In fact, it ensures it. Now we're using it more efficiently.
Well, typically, when greater fuel economy increases the use of gasoline because you drive more because it's more economical. Now, if it's true that we start to conserve, that means the demand falls, which means the price of oil falls, which means we only go to low-cost countries, which means we're only going to get it out of where it seeps out of the ground. We don't have to drill for it in the Middle East or Venezuela or Mexico. So our percentage dependency on foreign oil will not change.
What do you make of it?
The only way you're ever going to drive down the use of oil is to drive up the price. You know, if the price stays high or goes high and stays high, then people will use less. No way, that's just a simple economics. But if you allow the price to stay low, and this is the argument that the automakers have always had against CAFE and other regulations like that, is that if you don't do something, as you said, about the demand side to stimulate the demand for those smaller cars, then the efficiency goes up, the price is going to go down, and it's going to be counterproductive. You end up where we've been for the last 10 years or the last 20 years, where we got up to the 27 miles per gallon average for cars and then stagnated there. And as the cars actually got more efficient in terms of specific efficiency, cars kept maintaining that mileage, but horsepower is twice what it was 20 years ago. So, we're actually getting twice as much power out of the same gallon of gas. So cars actually are more efficient. The sticker numbers aren't any better. So unless you do something about that demand side, it's not going to make a difference. And as Jason said, it may well make things worse.
What's your take on it, John?
Well, look, it's the political reality, and everybody's facing the same standard. Yeah, everyone's got to deal with it. I don't buy this $1,300 additional cost.
Not at all.
$4,000.
I'm saying 5,000, but not just for the CAFE reasons. We've talked about here, I've said all along that, for the last two decades, the profits from trucks and SUVs subsidize the price of passenger cars in this country, with those products being tamped down. There's no way that the car companies are just going to sell cars at a loss anymore. They're going to raise the prices. So you put that together with the technology needed. And I'm saying that you're going to see the average MSRP across the line, top to bottom of the market, go up $5,000.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Right.
It's interesting that sound like Rush Limbaugh, the drive-by media, it was a love-in, right? It was an absolute love-in, except one publication, USA Today. And USA Today has been out there saying, CAFE has never worked. It has cost lives.
I'm not sure I buy the cost lives things because our fatality rate from accidents keeps going down.
It would have gone down even further.
Yeah,
but
maybe. I'm not sure I buy that.
It's a question now if there is a safety implication. We have to have some breakthroughs in innovation to get to this. that don't implicate the safety of our consumers.
You know, I don't buy that. I think the engineers have been brilliant at improving the safety of cars. A lot more crush space. You got airbags in there and that sort of thing. You know, even this video that the Institute for Highway Safety, Insurance Institute ran of, you know, a smart smashing head-on into, I think it was a Mercedes. C-Class Mercedes. Yeah, yeah. You know, the point is, I think the dummy broke its leg or something like that. It's actually, from a safety standpoint, a pretty impressive video, even though from somebody who's not versed in safety, they see this thing bounce back and spin, and it looks horrific. But, you know, think about Indy cars or racing cars, F1 cars, going into a wall, and you see these things explode. They're throwing off energy. That's the same thing with the Smart.
How much does an Indy car cost?
The point is, you can design cars to throw off energy. And we design cars now to absorb everything.
You've got a small car, though, like a Smart or a Honda Fit, you know, other you know, B-segment cars, there isn't much that you can throw off. You don't have much choice but to dissipate that energy somehow within the car. You know, I mean, with an Indy car, you know, you've got open wheels and wings and all kinds of other bits and pieces. You know, the engine that, you know, can fly off because you've just got this one little tub where the driver's sitting.
You got helmets and harnesses.
And, you know, in a road car, you know, you've got the bulk of the volume of the car being taken up by the passenger space, and you have to protect that, and you don't have a whole lot else left outside of that to throw away weight. And if you're gonna start you know, really attacking the mileage problem, you know, one of the things you've got to do is cut the weight of cars. And, you know, that's one of the things that's really going to drive up cost, you know, to start using aluminum and carbon fiber and materials like that. That really drives up the cost quickly.
And the repair cost.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But coming back to your question about the CAFE standards, I've said all along, this is not a question of technology. And I used to say before the collapse, it wasn't a question of money either. But it's really a question of timing. Because the 2010 models are done. You know, stick a fork in them, they're done. They're going down the line practically right now. So that means, and the 2011s are pretty much done.
Yeah,
forget that.
They're baked.
So that means between 2012... In 2016,
4 years.
4 years. That's one, really, a little over one design cycle. You've got to retool everything.
Oh,
everything,
yeah.
everything. And I'm just saying, I don't see that happening.
And you have to be able to price for it.
And what I think is going to happen, you know, Ford is going to say, oh, geez, we just hit our quota, our allotment, our average on F-150s. Stop building F-150s for the rest of the year. And you know what's going to happen to the ones that are left over? The price is going to skyrocket on them. And that's what I see coming is we're going to have cars and engines going on some sort of quota system that once the automaker says, whoop, we can't build any more of those or we're over CAFE.
Wait till you get close to hitting the new standard, whether it's, you know, as they graduate. Trucks that have great torque and towing capacity are going to be like guns and bullets right now. You won't be able to find them because everybody's going to say, I got to get the one I want now, mm-hmm. and I'm going to get it before the new, that happened with diesel trucks mm-hmm. and the heavy-duty diesels right. before the new diesel standard came in. Freightliner, all those, Daimler, all those guys were selling like crazy in that part of the commercial truck market. Because the customers were getting under the wire before the prices
were going
to go up.
Yeah, because it added like, what, $8,000 just to the price of the engine?
Yeah, well, there's also a lot of interesting technology coming to trucks in the next couple of years. I mean, next year Ford's going to introduce their EcoBoost engines in the F-150. And I've had a chance to drive one briefly and can't get into any details about what it was like, but I think people are going to be extremely surprised when that truck comes to market next year with the V6
I drove it, too, and I don't remember them embargoing me. Of course, I drove it a year ago, but I was impressed.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing had instant response. I mean, there was no turbo lag. The only thing that I criticized it for, and I told the Ford people, was it just doesn't sound as good as they had a Chevy 5-liter there, you know, a Silverado, and the V8 just sounds good. So my advice to them was, play around with the exhaust and the tuning and all that, because if you get the exhaust note right and the induction noise right, you'll be able to fool most people into believing they've got a V8 under the hood. That's how good I thought the EcoBoost and the F-Series was.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, Ford's been pushing the whole, their tagline for the new F-150 has been, you know, that it's got capability. And, you know, one of the things they're definitely going to be able to do with this EcoBoost is not give up any capability while getting, you know, much better fuel economy out of it.
Yep.
Nice graphic there.
Yeah. Well, that's the EcoBoost engine.
Free advertisement for Ford Motor Company.
Yeah, right.
Oh, Lord.
Are we going to get Robin now?
We are going to get Robin Miller, one of the best motorsports journalists in the business, to join the show, because the Indy 500 is this coming Sunday, the greatest spectacle in racing. And so, Ben, can we get Robin on the phone?
Is that him in the toilet?
No, that's the miracle of Skype.
It's a lifeline on Who Wants to Be
Hello?
A Millionaire.
Hello, Robin. You're live with us on Out of Line After Hours with Peter DeLorenzo, Jason Vines, and Sam Abulsamid.
How you guys doing?
Hey, Robin. How are you?
What's happening?
Well, we're just talking about your credentials, and we wondered what you thought about the race coming up Sunday. Who do you like, and what are the stories we need to?
I mean, you'd be crazy not to pick Castro Neves or Briscoe just because they look like they're on a different track. I mean, and they've run so many more miles than anybody except Frank Keating and Dixon. And I went up and sat with the spotters the other day in turn three. And you can really, I mean, in traffic and running a race trim and full loads of fuel, I mean, the two Penske cars look like they're on a different track.
Yeah.
Now, will that change if it gets to be 85 degrees on Sunday? I don't know, maybe. It might. But I think Penske won this race 14 times, boys, because he's lucky. I mean, they've had some luck, but they always figure it out. And I mean, the only thing they haven't been able to do is nobody's been able to run in the heat. Now, that could change things, but nobody's going to adjust faster than they will. And Dixon looked really good the other day when he was out running. But, you know, I just think that, I mean, in the last 50 oval track races, Penske, Ganassi, and Andretti Green have won 47 of them. And the last 10 Indy 500s, they've won 9 of them. So, I mean, come on. Who could upset him? I don't know. I mean, Graham Rahal's he's been fast, and I think he's a hell of a talent. And their team's figured things out with these IRL cars. And you'd like to see Paul Tracy, but he's on a team that hadn't made a pit stop yet this year. So,
right. Hey, Robin.
8 or 9 or 10 pit stops, tough to do.
Robin, here's a question. You know, everybody criticizes the IRL right now because it's essentially a spec series. Everyone has essentially the same chassis. They all have the same engine. How come Ganassi, Penske, and Andretti Green are so much above everyone else if this is a spec series?
Well, because they've had the cars for 7 years, whatever it is, and they've had the most money to go to the wind tunnel, the 7-post shaker rig, and I mean, this is down to a science of putting decals and body work, and there's so many little minute details because, you know, you're scratching for a tenth of a second, and I think that's why they've been so dominant. I mean, last year, you know, Newman Haas Lanigan is as good a team as there is in North America, but they didn't have an IRL. They had one guy that was in the IRL on their team last year, and this year they've got Martin Pare, who's an engineer, and he's really helped Graham, I think, get the mechanical grip, and these cars are so much better. And, you know, he had a lot of experience with Andretti Green. But, you know, I mean, yeah, the cars are identical and the engines are identical, but it's the little fine-tuning details that those three teams and the head start they've had on everybody else that really have put the distance between them and everybody else.
Yeah, not to mention, Robin, the financial resources that they
exactly.
They can afford to delve into those fine little details that.
They spent for a while that Honda was spending a lot of money on Andretti Green. They were kind of the house team. They had their own. They had like 7 different front suspensions. They had 3 different track widths, and this is the first year they finally made a standard wheelbase, so you couldn't have three different wheelbases, one to qualify and one to race, and one short track, one big track, one road course. They're trying to cut a little bit of the expenses out, but it's still out of control because it takes $7 or $8 million to run up front, and you can't get a $2 million sponsor because you get 175,000 people watching your race on TV on Versus. I mean, the financial pyramid is as upside down as it can be, and Peter knows a lot more about cars and money and business than I do. But somebody needs to come in there and explain to these boys, this is why this isn't working.
Yeah.
So, well, speaking of not working, though, I mean, what about F1? In fact, we got a question from a viewer here, C-Tech. He says, a question for Robin, the proposed spending cap limit on F1, could that open the door for others to come in, say, like even Cadillac, to polish their image?
Well, I think that's why you saw Peter Windsor and Kenny Anderson saying they're going to have a team, because if they raise $60 million, and we all laughed and said, you can't go Formula One racing with $60 million. Well, if the salary cap comes through, which now I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but it's possible. And Bernie was saying the other day, there might be 9 or 10 new teams, 2 American teams. We keep hearing Roger Penske might be back in Formula One next year. And Formula One is the most compelling season in the world, right? Who would have ever thought that was going to be the most compelling racing, before the season started? And yet they continue to be run in disarray. I mean, Max Ferrari's pissed off and thinking about leaving, and if Ferrari leaves, that's going to, how upside down is that going to turn Formula One?
Yeah, well, one rumor right now is that Ferrari, if they do get pissed off enough, is going to go back after Le Mans, an overall victory at Le Mans.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
Montezemolo is going to be the official starter at Le Mans this year, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
kind of. Well, think about this. It reminds me of CART in the early 90s. They end up with 28 fully funded cars, end up with Nigel Mansell, full houses everywhere they go, pretty good TV ratings, right, even with NASCAR. And in spite of the car owners, they had this kick-ass series. Well, it kind of reminds me of Formula One. They get 1 week they're going to give badges, the next week they're going to give points to the guys that win races only, then they change. Every other week something major changes. It looks like nobody knows what's going on. They're threatening to throw Grand Prix out right and left. Ferrari's threatening to quit and sue them. And still, they have the great race.
Yeah. Jenson Button's dream year.
Yeah.
Who would have thunk that in December?
He was always a nice guy when he came here at the U.S. Grand Prix. I always kind of felt sorry for him because he'd be back there flogging around in 15th. And then you remember he's making $12 million a year. You don't feel so sorry for him anymore.
Yeah.
Hey, Robin, I remember back when Indy was packed for qualifying. And I was watching this weekend, and it was high drama. It was great television, especially at the very end there on Sunday. And there's, like, nobody there. What do they got to do to really get the sport popular again in the United States?
Well, they got to have American race drivers that are stars. They got to make Graham Rahal, Marco Andretti, Danica Patrick, Ryan Hunter Ray. These people got to win races and championships because, I like Tony Kanaan and Scott Dixon and Frank Keady and, but nobody in the United States cares. And the reason that everybody cared in the 60s and 70s and 80s was because you had a bunch of American heroes. And there hasn't been 10,000 people a whole day since the split, and there probably weren't 3,000 people there last weekend total. And, until you change the rules and you get some innovation back and you get a lot of different manufacturers and you reduce the cost so you can go racing for $2 or $3 million, you're going to struggle to have 33 cars. And, there's the thing that the IRL makes me crazy about is all the IRLs, they'll talk about how dramatic last weekend was. Well, guess what? Bump Day was always dramatic. It was dramatic when Roger Penske missed a show in 95 and Rahal missed a show in 93. You don't need to manufacture drama at Indianapolis. And giving a guy 12 chances to qualify is an insult to every guy that ever busted his ass and got killed at Indy trying to make the race. And the sooner Tony George sells the track to somebody that has a clue about business and racing, the better off we'll all be.
Well, Robin, we also remember, when the 200-mile-per-hour barrier was this quest, it was huge. It was 200,000 people on qualifying weekend. And
sure.
That's why a few years ago I proposed pressing the reset button on racing. And, just throwing out the rules currently and going back to a point where you run what you brung, but the cars are slow enough that it'll take years to build up speed again. We need the creativity. We need the multiple approaches. We need the occasional small car garage genius who shows up with something that no one expected. And until we see that again, you know, yeah, there'll be a major component missing at Indy, although I still think the start of the Indy 500 is the most electrifying moment in all of sport.
Well, it is until Brian Barnhart took over. Now they're single file when they get to the start finish line, because that's the front row. And row 7 still in the short chute. You look at the pictures of Indy in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and there's 11 rows of three 100 yards apart because they're all professional drivers, and now we got all these, about half of this field don't even belong in this race. But to go back to what Peter said, Tony Kottman is the only chance IndyCar Racing's got. If they would turn it over to him, he's got a lot of good ideas. He's the smartest, savviest guy that's come along in 30 years. He understands that it needs to have a complete overhaul. But, you know, he's the lone voice in the wilderness because, I mean, you know, the combined IQ in the IRL and the IMS office left Tony Kottman's less than triple digits.
Well, one other thing that we maybe need is another Indy Sunday where the temperature is only 65 degrees, like that one back in the 90s when half the field seemed to crash in the first lap.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. But, you know, it is to live here your whole life. And if you weren't paying attention, you wouldn't even know that it was the month of May in Indianapolis. There's not the city just doesn't embrace it like they used to because nobody cares. And this thing ought to be a week-long event. 3 days of practice, qualify for a day, take a day off, have a parade, have the race. See you later.
Haven't seen it in the sports pages whatsoever.
Yeah.
No. It's not being covered. Hey, Robin, what do you make, you know, of what's going to happen with racing? Only because every car company in the world right now is just bleeding red ink. You know, we saw Honda drop out of F1, although Braun picked up, you know, a bargain basement, you know, team at that point. But in all forms of racing, whether it's NASCAR, Indy, drag racing, whatever, what do you think is going to be the impact with all these companies losing so much money? They got to be looking at how much they're spending in racing and scratching their heads and wondering, is it worth it?
Well, the good news from the IndyCar standpoint is there's no money in it right now anyway, so they're not going to lose anything. There's no sponsors. No, I mean, I'm serious. There's no sponsors. There's no manufacturers. And nobody cares. I mean, Honda's the only one that spends any money. I think they're getting pretty perturbed with their treatment by the IRL. So I would say that, you know, I would just have to think that, you know, NASCAR's got to be quaking in their boots no matter what they say. I mean, that's got to be something that...
Brian France made another media appearance, and he's the original. He's inherited the mantle from Alfred E. Newman. You know, what me worry, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, I look at drag racing and they're down to what they have the other day. They have 15 top fuel cars or 16 funny cars at the last race. I can't believe I went to a sprint car right there and there were 53 sprint cars. But it was just, you know, that's just little guys at Bloomington and Paragon down here in Indianapolis where they can tow, you know, they don't have to tow too far. And it's like Peter said, this thing has to go all the way back to square one, start all over. Guys coming up with creative ideas.
Yeah. EV races.
You wrote a nice piece about Larry Rice, Robin. That was very nice.
Oh, yeah. Great guy and a very underrated race driver. A lot of people didn't know much about old Larry.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, that guy was a hell of a race driver, and he had no ego, and he never talked about himself, and you would have never known he drove race cars because he never talked about it.
Robin, we really appreciate you coming on here, but I got one thing that I got to ask you because I've known about this for years. You're the guy who broke the story on Al Unser Jr. having a again. Oh, we did. Oh, darn it. Oh, well. It was going to be a good one.
Can we get him back?
Hang on, we'll try.
Okay.
Well, speaking of races where there's a series where there's some innovation going on, the American Le Mans series.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's probably the one series where you've got a lot of different types of vehicles, different powertrains.
I'll call you back. Thank you.
To leave a voice message.
Yeah. We're not going to get Robin back. It was worth trying.
Last weekend in Utah, the Corsa Motorsports team was the first one to run a hybrid. in there, you know, running a hybrid drivetrain, and you know, goes way beyond what the F1 teams are doing with Curtis.
Well, it's clear, you know, especially with the regulations going the way they are at Le Mans, that's going to be the manufacturer hotbed. I really believe, you know, Formula One is in real danger of shooting themselves in the head, and it's going to be a long recovery. I think the Le Mans series, the American Le Mans series, but really Le Mans, which is the greatest sports car race in the world, they're going to embrace alternative fuels and technology, and I think that's going to become the real hotbed of a manufacturer participation.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I just wish the ALMS had more following in the U.S. because I think people need to really go out and see those races.
Cause yeah, if people watch the ALMS races, I mean, they'd love it because, I mean, that is the best racing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Well, there's all different kinds of cars, and they're not, you know, silhouettes.
Different sounds.
Right. Yeah,
yeah.
Right. No,
it's amazing to listen to them go by.
Hey, but I want to get back to some of the industry news,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, if we get
Jason,
Robin.
I want to go right to Jason. Chrysler's got a new chairman. What do you make of that? Or is going to have a new chairman? This guy, Steve Kidder? No, Robert Kidder.
Isn't it amazing that the new chairman's last name's a Kidder? Actually, the media got it wrong, or Chrysler PR got it wrong, or somebody got it wrong when it was first reported he was chairman and CEO.
Yeah, that's not CEO.
He's
not.
Yeah, I think Marchionne is going to be CEO.
Marchionne is going to be CEO. Kidder's going to be the chairman, appointed by the Treasury. They're going to have this new board. So the guy looks like he has great credentials. So what?
Yeah, but he's chosen by the task force. I mean, come on, this is a private equity guy, you know, who's got some CEO experience.
Private equity at the end, but he did his chops along the way.
Yeah.
So you never know. Okay, guy could be a jerk, could be a great guy.
But is Chrysler in danger of losing Jim Press? I mean, you know, Nardelli's running the show, and now Nardelli's going to be gone.
I'm not sure where Jim Press is in all this. Will they want him? Does he want to stay? I think he wants to stay.
I would hope he does. He's,
you know, I mean, Marchionne's not likely to be spending all his time in Auburn Hills. I mean, he's going to be in Italy. So he may be the CEO of the company.
Or Stuttgart.
Or Rüsselsheim.
Rüsselsheim, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's probably going to spend most of his time in Europe. So that, you know, leaves basically day-to-day operations over here open for Jim Press. I mean, yeah, he could end up as COO or something.
Who would think that you'd want some continuity at Chrysler from a guy that's been there less than 2 years? But he still has credibility with the dealer body, although that's been strained a little bit by begging them to buy cars in February, and they all took the allotment, and now they're screwed.
Well, he could blame the task force for that.
Yeah, you know, I'd put everything on Obama. But he still has a lot of credibility. He's wasted a little bit. Maybe it was forced upon him to waste some. The dealers that are going to come through this are excited. Those that weren't on the cutting block are excited because they realize this is something they've all wanted to happen. Chrysler's been
talking. They just wanted it to be the other guy.
We've said it many times. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Right.
Now these guys are going to be left standing. They're going to increase their throughput. It's not going to get to the Toyota level, but it's going to improve. They're going to get back bay service stuff. This is a gravy train potentially for them if they come through this. The faster Chrysler can get out of the B word, the better. And they get it's a do over. That's what it is. It's a do over for these dealers. It's a do over for the company. And you know, you thought they were dead. You've been saying they're dead for 2 months. I don't think they're dead. I think they have a shot. There is a pulse.
What about this GMAC thing?
Of GMAC getting more money.
Oh, yeah.
Got $20 billion, would they get?
I mean, at some point, Al Mulally is going to do a big timeout to Washington and say, okay, you're
helping them too much.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, this thing about GM and Chrysler getting more money pumped into GMAC so they can make better deals and better incentives and better financing, at some point, the playing field is not going to be level.
We said this, though, a couple weeks ago. Sorry, Sam. Ford was on the precipice of being a little cocky, and they've been a little on the verge of being cocky the last few weeks and making these announcements, we're better, and taking advantage of GM and Chrysler using the B word. Well, now it could come to bite them in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
That you didn't want to be associated with this, Well, to be associated with this, you get some of the spoils.
Yeah, but, you know, this financing thing, that's really pushing the envelope. And
well, the only thing is, you know, look, Chrysler and GM dealers are not in the in the leasing game right now. They're giving away screaming deals if you want to buy. But, you know, as we know, there's roughly 20% of the car-buying public will only lease. If you don't have a lease, they're out of there.
No, that's in this area. Nationwide, it's about 10%.
No, it's more than that.
This area, it's more than 20%.
It's 25% in this area.
Well, you know, okay, so it's 17%, I'll call
whatever,
it. But
okay.
I've been told it's closer to 20. And if you don't have a lease, a competitive lease, they walk. They're only there to lease. So I think this financing, because, I mean, if you go look at the lease prices from GM or Chrysler, they're
just
pricey. But if you look at their sticker prices, it's giveaway.
Well, and what's killing their lease? The residual.
Yeah.
Right.
The residuals
has
fallen off the table, which affects dramatically the lease. So, but if you want to go out and pay cash for a car, boy, you're getting a hell of a bargain right now.
But here's another one, and I'd go to you on this, Peter. Mark McNabb leaving GM. I mean, here's a guy that they pulled in. I don't even think he's been there 2 years.
13 months. Mark LaNeve plucked him from Nissan to run their premium group.
After he'd been at Mercedes and before that at Nissan, again, long-term Nissan. I know where he's going.
You know, I think he bailed because I think he felt that this wasn't a place he wanted to be associated with anymore.
My rumor mill says he's going to join Penske on the Saturn deal.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there is an interesting
that's exclusive.
That's
here.
That's what Jason, yeah, that's so what said.
Oh, we got a picture of Mark McNabb up there right now.
Would McNabb run the new Saturn under Penske ownership?
Well, it depends, you know, what is the new Saturn? They are buying a distribution network.
Right.
Period.
But they hired Tom Lasorda.
And let's see what Tom brings. I don't know. You know, Tom's a friend. I'm not sure what he brings to the party.
Well, here's what he brings to the party is the way I read it is here's a guy who's trotted around the world trying to find partners for Chrysler. So he's gone off and visited with the Russians, and then Chrysler's got deals with the Russians and the Chinese, although that hasn't happened yet.
No.
And he's got deals with Nissan. So here's a guy who knows how to go talk to car companies about getting product or giving product or sharing product. And that's what got to be, I got to believe, what Penske wants to tap into.
You've got a Saturn.
That knowledge.
You've got a Saturn distributorship now. Some of the best stores. Great locations. They're not dualed. They're by themselves. They got the best lineup they've ever had. To me, it's the saddest story of the breakup
of
GM.
I agree, totally.
So how do you keep that going past 2011 when GM stopped supplying? Now, if I know right, the View came from Daewoo?
Yeah.
Okay? That's a phenomenal. I have two great cars. Where do you get those cars from? Do they come from China? And do you keep the quality up? Because the quality is terrific in these cars. And the performance and the fuel economy. Is it a mishmash?
In the View, you mean.
In the View
in
and
Saturn,
everything else.
Right.
Is it a mishmash? Do you take something from here, something from there? How do you get it all together to have some continuity of what a Saturn is?
Right.
You've got a great dealer body. Now, I'm all for Roger Penske doing this. This guy's a wonder worker. And look what he did for Detroit during the Super Bowl. Everything he touches almost turns to gold.
Almost. He's made some mistakes, but we're all
human. Yes, but well, yeah, we are.
What about this? If Fiat ends up taking over Opel, and Saturn's been basically selling Opels for the last several years, aside from the Outlook, you know, is there any possibility that they could do a deal with Opel to continue a supply of vehicles, you know, get the new Astra, get the Insignia, you know, maybe something, you know, so do something with Fiat.
Sorta is close with Marchionne.
Is he?
And yes, and Fiat will own Opel, and oh, it's just one big happy retarded family.
So yeah, I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's hard to keep up with. I mean, every day it's like you know, I was going to say pick up the paper. We no longer pick up papers. You know, you get online and it's like, oh, my God, another bombshell has hit this industry. So
we're almost time for rapid fire.
I think it's time for rapid fire.
We're waiting for our intern.
Our graphic.
Yeah.
Who's out in the back room smoking.
So I guess we didn't get Robin back, huh?
No, they tried there.
Got his voicemail.
Right. What other topics haven't we gotten to here?
Do I get to repeat my epitaph for Nerdelli?
Which is?
The wrong guy at the wrong
wrong guy at the wrong company at the wrong time.
Yeah, exactly. I repeated it often lately when people call me.
Well, here's a question we got from a Mike Klepak from Clinton Township, Michigan. He says, "How are these car companies going to save any money by cutting all these dealers? I mean, The dealers buy cars. They're independent businessmen, or people, I should say. You know, so you kill 30% of your dealers. What's that do for
you? I don't buy that argument at all.
Why?
The fact is, if the company is profitable and the dealers aren't profitable, sooner or later the company won't be profitable. And it's the other way around, too. If you have a dealer body that's not making money and they're not making money, the company's never going to make money. Because after a while, they're going to stop ordering cars. They just can't afford to order cars. They can't afford to advertise. Sales go down. That affects the mothership. You have to have a strong dealer body making lots of money, like Toyota. And when that happens, they keep ordering
cars.
Like
Toyota used to be, you mean?
Well,
because they're bleeding
right
now.
Well, they're bleeding right now, but everybody's bleeding. But in a realistic market going forward, Toyota dealerships print money. Okay, Lexus dealers print money. And if you have a strong distributor base, that will make you a very rich manufacturer down the road. Absolutely, because they'll keep ordering cars. They'll keep selling those cars. They'll keep servicing those cars. They keep ordering, and you have a pipeline that's working.
But here's my question. I mean, Chrysler says they're going to get rid of 25% of their dealers, which represent only 17% of their business. I think that's the number. 14%. I guarantee you, just take 14% right off the top of the sales, because the dealers who are left aren't automatically going to get all that
business.
No, but
the fact is, where Chrysler's seen it was I was there when we did the consolidation. And unfortunately, the consolidation, when I was there and we said we all had to do it, and the dealers were all a part of it, you'd have a dealer that says, I'm going to buy this underperforming dealer. I'm going to give him $2 million, get rid of his crappy little store. And I was selling 1,000 units a year, and he was selling 100. And when I got my new store with all three brands and I was a centrally located one, I went from 1,000 to 1,500 or 2,000. Some of them went up 30, 40, 70%. Because that's where people go. They get the service. They get a nice-looking dealership. It works. GM's been trying to do this. Ford's been trying to do this. Chrysler's been trying to do this before times got tough, because they know they needed a strong dealer body with a lot of throughput and a lot of service so they'd order cars. They couldn't do it back then because of franchise laws. And now, thank God for bankruptcy. The only good part of this bankruptcy is they got to throw away those state franchise laws, which are the most onerous laws in this country, and they get a clean house and they get to do a do-over. And that's why if you talk to a good dealer right now, a guy that's selling a lot of cars, a lot of new cars, not basing all of his business on used cars, he is excited as hell right now going forward, because he knows once the smoke clears, he's going to make a lot of money. And when you get a dealer body that's healthy, the company is going to be healthy.
But you know, a bunch of these dealers that are getting cut are suing now, you know, trying to use those same state franchise laws, you know, saying that, you know, getting cut this way arbitrarily and under bankruptcy contravenes those laws. You know, who's going to win?
We got a president of the United States that's putting his will and his socialist techniques on it, and they're pushing this through. We thought, what, 2-3 weeks ago, there's no way that this bankruptcy would go through this fast. Wall Street Journal says it's going to take 2 years. No, it's moving at a clip.
Hey,
at
2 shows ago, because I wasn't here last time, I said it was going to be 60 days. Because remember, we all talked about it.
I said 45 to 60
days. Yeah. It's, you know, didn't vote for the guy, wouldn't vote for him again, but you got to give him some credit. He has pushed through a lot of shit in these first 100 days, and it's working. I got to give him credit. It's working. And, you know, it's kind of funny. The same Congress that called the big three stupid on national television is now protesting them getting their house in order and doing the right management decisions. I don't get it.
Well, that comes down to all politics being local, though. You know, they're hearing noise from their dealers that are in their districts and their states, you know, saying they don't want to be cut. That's, you know, that's where that comes from.
Some of these dealers, and I told you this, it was last week or 2 weeks ago. One dealer a few years ago, using the Chrysler, Dodge, and Plymouth sign, even though Plymouth had been gone for 6 years, sold 3 new cars in 1 year. Hundreds, if not thousands, of used cars. He was using the brand image of the company to sell used cars. If you want to be a used car dealer, be a used car dealer, period. But if you're going to be new, be new.
We got to do a whole show on used cars at some point. But I think it's time to do rapid fire. Ben, roll the graphic.
Sam, watch us. This is breathtaking.
I love that. And Jason, you got the
question. Is that your intern?
That's my intern. Yeah, right.
Bad Nickel on Twitter asks, how is it not price gouging when gas just went up on the forecast of a busy Memorial Day? Aren't supplies higher than ever?
Well, that must be a young viewer because that happens. That's always happened.
That's happened every Memorial Day, every 4th of July, every Thanksgiving, every Labor Day for as long as I've been around.
Yeah, I remember I predicted a couple months ago that gas is going to be 3.25 on Memorial Day. I guess I'm going to miss, but it's definitely.
But not by a whole lot.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you the other thing that shocked me today driving by the gas station, diesel, 16 cents a gallon, the station I drove by, cheaper than regular gasoline.
20 cents.
Not medium grade, not premium. Cheaper than regular, you know, the cheapest gas out there. So, but yeah, I mean, every big holiday, driving holiday, they raise the price of gas. And yeah,
but why is diesel going down? Is it a lot because trucking firms are in danger too? They're not shipping as much. And
part of it is worldwide demand for diesel is down too.
I hear all the explanations, and I'm not sure I buy in.
A lot of the worldwide spike in diesel prices last year was coming out of China, coming from demand in China, and a lot of that has fallen off.
Right. Okay, next,
Jamie Thompson. Ask, why is it taking so long for General Motors to go bankrupt? What a great line. Isn't it best for all concerned to plan for the future and change the way of doing business? Well, yes, but
yeah.
Why is it taking so long, Peter, for GM to go bankrupt?
They're going bankrupt next week.
Right, right.
So, Jamie Thompson, stay tuned.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Steve Loves Cars on Twitter asks, how much will GM have to pay Penske to take Saturn?
It's the other way around. Roger's going to pay GM to take
$10 bucks.
No, what do you think? Guess here. And put a buck on the table. Closest one wins it.
Well, there's how many dealers, Saturn?
400
and something. So what's each one worth? You know, $1 million? I don't know. $500 million, I'll say.
$500 million, what do you say?
$1 billion.
I would say no more than $500 million just because they
have
the product.
We already paid $500 million. This is the price.
No,
actually, I'm changing my mind. I agree with Peter now because there's Goodwill, Blue Sky, blah, 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 blah.
And they have no product.
Right.
So you're taking $300 million?
I'll take $300 to $400 million.
Well, you got to take
one. $300 million.
$300 million, $1 billion. Yeah. I'm going to undercut your showcase, $999 million.
He'll take the profits he got from buying Detroit diesel to buy Saturn.
Sabakis on Twitter. Any thoughts on how Chrysler selected the dealerships to close?
Well, you know, look, how do you close dealers real fast? You look for minutiae, technicalities of how'd you break your franchise agreement. Oh, your capitalization ratio isn't right. Oh, your inventory levels aren't at the proper level. Oh, your CSI scores are, you know, you broke the agreement, boom, you're gone. That's the easy way to do it.
And a lot of it just comes down to, as we talked about before, the sales numbers. You know, how many cars per year is this dealer selling in a region versus, you know, other dealers in the same region?
Chrysler had already mapped out the entire United States on where their dealers were, where the population had moved, where they were over-dealered, where they had. If you look at most of the dealers on the list, they were either a Dodge dealer by themselves or a Chrysler Jeep dealer by themselves, or most of them were dualed. And so they're not going to go out of business, by the way. They're with a GMC. The real bad ones are a Dodge Pontiac dealer. Poor guy.
Right. Yeah.
He's totally screwed.
Toast.
But the fact is, the numbers, and I'm a big fan of the dealers and their impact on communities, but this number of 40,000 employees lost from the Chrysler, it's absolute BS. Those employees will move to other dealers or they'll stay in the dual dealership. What remains? We have a shortage of mechanics in this country. And as an industry, we've been working to recruit more mechanics out of the military or whatever. These are good paying jobs. So there is no shortage of work in this area because we have hundreds of millions of cars on the road that need service. George Ballou asks, why are we going to so much trouble to replace our fossil fuel-burning autos with electric cars? Wouldn't it be much easier just to replace all those oil and gas-burning residual residential boilers and furnaces with 100% efficient electric baseboard heat or 250% efficient heat pumps? Wow.
Okay, next question.
Well, no, I'd just say, hey, you got to do it all. You got to do your furnace in your home, and you got to do your car, and blah, blah, blah.
Transportation only accounts for 20% of CO2 emissions. You know, right. Another 20% is, or 25% is industry. And so, yeah, I mean, you've got to look at all those things. You know, one of the problems we've had in the last couple of years, it's been way too much focus on the auto industry and CO2 emissions,
right,
and not enough on all the other sources.
I look forward to fuel cells for your home.
I want one.
I mean, I
want one of those Honda Home Energy Stations.
That's the only fuel cell that makes sense.
One of the offshoots of the GM hydrogen program is that, you know, they're way down the road on fuel cell for the home. And I'm sitting there, why are we waiting?
Yep. You know? I'm for it.
This is a good question for our viewers. And I've lost it. How long, this is from Ride with Wes on Twitter. How long is an automaker required to keep making parts for a defunct brand?
Oh.
10 or 15?
Oh. I think it's 10.
I believe it's 10 years because, and you got to keep all the tooling. You got to make service parts.
Well,
you got to stamp out fenders and hoods.
I don't know if you actually have to keep making them for the whole time, but you have to have enough of a supply to last that
long. Right, but, you know, realistically, you can't make all those parts and just warehouse them. You have to make them.
Yeah, I mean, they'll probably be making Pontiac parts and Saturn parts for at least another 2 or 3 years.
A long time to come. Yep. That is a good question.
I'm going to share this one. New car news. What would it take to get Jason back to Chrysler? Money.
How much money, Jason?
And this new car news is my wife's now. Drewsome wants to know. Drewsome, obviously, is the pen name for Bob Lutz. Do you believe in global warming? Do you?
Do I believe in global warming? Absolutely. Do I believe it's anthropogenic, i.e. man-made? I'm not persuaded.
Those are big words from a little man, John. Yeah.
Hey, I'm only little mentally.
Peter?
I agree with John.
I largely agree with John, too. I think, you know, there's definitely some human influence, but there's also other influence.
Oh, I believe we're contributing to it.
Yeah.
Are we causing it? I'm not yet persuaded.
I don't believe it's true. I'm in the Bob Lutz camp. I think it's a cruel hoax by the university people.
Sadly.
We were talking in 1972 about a new ice age. However, saying that, side on the error of judgment and prevent it. So do whatever we can to help the planet and conserve fuel.
Well, look, this is where the interests of those in national security and environmentalism coincide. We want to get off foreign oil. Okay, boom. Let's get together and make it happen.
It's almost like now with the new standard. Okay, let's stop arguing about it.
Well,
let's just move
it's
on.
There. Let's move on. Right.
Scott in Cleveland asks, what is the probability that the North American International Auto Show will be moved to a Rock Financial Show place in 2011?
Unless, we were talking about this before the show started.
Unless Dave Bing pulls off a miracle, which people are expecting now that he will, I think it will be a Rock Financial in 2011. But
I totally disagree.
Everyone says it's going to be.
No, look, Dave Bing's going to make this thing happen. You know, we've got several idiots on the Detroit City Council who are going to get bulldozed in the New Deal. And everybody recognizes it's got to be in Detroit. It's got to be in Detroit.
I agree.
Even Brooks Patterson says it should be in Detroit, and he's leading the charge.
It's got to be in Detroit, but maybe they should bulldoze Cobo Hall and put it in Rock Financial for 2 years and build the proper structure where Cobo Hall is.
That's not a bad point at all.
But it's not going to happen.
But it ain't going to happen.com.
Sammy, what do you think?
Oh,
good move.
I think it probably will, at least temporarily. But I think it will. You know, I can't see him having Cobo ready with an expansion. Nobody wants to be in there anymore. None of the automakers want to be there.
I agree with John. I believe that next week, the week after Memorial Day, Dave Bing will get a deal that everybody agrees on, and they will break ground almost immediately to get it going. And it could be the fact that the 2010 auto show is in a temporary location.
No, 10's going to be there. Maybe 11. Maybe at 11 and 12.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We need jobs in Detroit, so they may start it and, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if they start working on it now, though, You know, is it going to be in a condition that they can use it for the auto show next January?
Yeah, I want it in downtown Detroit because I love the Hotel Pontchartrain. It is such a wonderful thing if you've ever been there. The rats are just the most mature rats.
I was wondering where you were going with that because I agree with the rat comment.
I'll answer that. John Cooley, I apologize if I pronounced your name wrong. How much will the new mileage regulations actually cost? The Obama administration said $1,300.
We already covered that.
We covered it. I'll just throw out one thing today, though. Ricardo, you know, which does all the powertrain engineering, said $5,000 to $12,000.
Absolutely agree. $5,000.
$5,000, yeah. $12,000 sounds way too high to me, but we're
saying
five, right?
Charles asks, isn't it rude to be checking your CrackBerry while on live TV? No, looking for questions and
yeah,
so
because
forth.
I get questions from.
Plus, this is decidedly and deliberately not traditional media.
Yes.
So, Charles,
on live TV, you don't drink wine either.
Yeah, drink wine or any.
You never know; it might be a fan mail from some flounder.
Okay, technical guys. JJ asks, why is there a kick when the gas engine kicks in? I thought the engine only charged the batteries; it never runs the drivetrain. That's how a Volt is different than the Prius, right?
Yeah. Basically, right now they're working to make sure that there isn't one. You know, the thing is, when the Volt is so quiet when it's running in EV mode that when anything like an engine does start up, I mean, you know, when you start up a regular car, you feel it when the engine starts up. So they're working to make that startup as smooth and quiet as possible so to minimize that transition.
By the way, they are working. Remember what we talked about, HERF? And I said that each manufacturer would have to produce their own sound signature for the race cars.
Right.
They have to do it for the electric cars. There's going to be sound signatures coming from these electric cars that are going to be designed by the manufacturer. So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, so the blind people know what's about to
happen. Well, you know, walking your dog or something.
Right.
Final question comes from Artemis77. He asks, Indian automaker Mahindra is planning to start selling their line of diesel pickups and SUVs in the U.S. this fall. Will they be a success?
Ooh, good question.
I always thought Mahindra was going to buy Hummer.
Well, that'd be smart for them to do.
Yeah.
To get a brand name that's recognized, yeah. You know, Mahindra's making some inroads in this country in farm tractors. And I could see farmers who like their Mahindra tractors, if there is such a buyer, saying, you know, what the hell? I guess I'll get one of their trucks, too. They're awfully damn cheap. That's going to be their selling card, is they're going to be priced under everybody.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Mahindra is going to make their 2009 target. I think it'll probably be at least 2010 or 11.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, the market is so weak right now, it'd be insane for anybody to try and step into it at this point.
Yeah.
We're going to save the questions we didn't get to tonight for next week.
How about, John, what about one more thing? So if this is the end of days, the end of the performance era as we know it, what's the one vehicle you would buy now to keep if you can't even mind to buy one?
Oh, God, that's so hard to say. The one that just pops into my mind is the Ford GT. I mean.
What about you, Jason? Would you get a Viper or something?
No. I think I've told you what I'd get. I'd get a four-door Jeep Wrangler.
A ZR1.
Yeah, I'm right with you.
Oh, ZR1, yeah.
That budget would be a ZR1.
Yeah, that's what I put on the website. I put black ZR1. Thank you very much.
You guys get
I like the atomic
the
orange
and
one I was driving a few weeks ago.
Waving.
I like the atomic orange one I was driving a few weeks ago. That looks amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, hey, NASA's even working on this, making fuel from algae. It's entirely possible in 5 years, you know, by 2015 when all this CAFE stuff, we go, who cares? Gas is 80 cents a gallon and it's carbon neutral.
Yeah. No, I mean, back in the early 70s, it was like the sky is falling, it's over.
Right.
And so you have to have perspective in this stuff. We have a new regulation, at least it's one regulation, move forward. And we're going to have a lull, no doubt. This is the peak of this performance era, and it's going to be a while before.
But, you know, and here's the one thing that's great about the electric cars, instant torque.
Oh, yeah.
Instant torque.
Torque is good.
And torque is good. And I think the environmentalists, you know, once and if electric cars catch on, they're going to go, we didn't think you were going to be driving these things that fast.
Well, and then who's the woman in charge of the California Air Resource Board?
Mary Nichols.
No, Mary Richards.
Mary Nichols. And she just announced, I sent you the email. She just announced, well, we're working on 2016 now. We're going to go more stringent.
Look, and how are they going to power all these cars in California? We know how, don't we? It's called coal in Nevada.
Right.
You know, and as Nevada vaporizes,
right,
California has all these clean cars.
Well, you know, look, I had Tom Caquette on a Skype interview a week or two ago, and I remember talking to him a couple of years ago and saying that, look, once we get to what is it? PNGV or no?
PZEV.
PZEV. Excuse me. Partial zero emission vehicles. He said, from a regulated emissions standpoint, that's the end of the game. That is the end of the game.
5 years ago, they didn't have the equipment to measure the emissions that low. And here's the one thing, a real boner I have with everything that's happened and with the environmentalists winning. CO2 is not a pollutant. It's not a pollutant. That's what plants live off of. But they won the day. They have it characterized as a pollutant. Our emissions on these vehicles are incredible. And just to give that little stat that I always loved, today's new SUV driving down the road gives off less emissions, less pollutants, than a 1965 Mustang sitting on the side of the road with its engine shut off. That is a fact, and it's true.
Well,
that's how clean these vehicles
are. And as you know,
are.
the PZEV vehicles in the L.A. basin, the air going in the engine is dirtier than the exhaust
coming out
the tailpipe.
So you just drive around.
And again, it was the CARB people who told me, with a PZEV vehicle, if you want to commit suicide, I know this is morbid, but if you park the car in a garage, close the doors, and run the engine, you're not going to die.
The Hemlock Society took off 10 years ago, took off killing yourself with a car in the garage.
Right. So, I mean, look, there's still issues with air pollution and water pollution. I totally agree. Let's get it as clean as it is or can be done. But the air we're breathing today, for all of us sitting here in this room, is the cleanest air we have breathed in our lives. And every now and then, you got to stop and say, we've made tremendous progress, folks. And we don't celebrate that. All we hear is every year is, oh, L.A. is the most polluted city. Yeah, it is. But guess what? Everybody living there has never
been. In 1970, it was a hell of a lot worse.
It was dramatically better.
Right.
Yeah. L.A. is dramatically better.
And when the dinosaurs lived in L.A. in the La Brea tar pits and they were farting, they gave off more methane that polluted the air more because of the trapping of the air in L.A. The air in L.A. is cleaner today than when the dinosaurs lived there.
Okay, well, we've ranted enough for this. We got to bring the show to a close, but Jason Vines, Peter DeLorenzo, and our guests in the studio here, Sam Abulsamed. Sam, great having you here, man.
My pleasure to be here.
And then we also got to say that, hey, you can follow us all at Twitter.com. It's Twitter.com/Autoline, or for Peter, Twitter.com/AutoExtremist. And you got a Twitter account there, Sam?
I do. It's my name, Sam Abulsamed, all in one word. And there's also
That's easy to spell.
Yeah. The Real Auto Blog. If you go to The Real Auto Blog,
then they can find out how to spell your name, and then they can.
Or just go to Auto Blog, and you'll see my name there.
Yeah. Do I get my little spot?
Yeah.
If you want to help hungry people, if you're not in the Detroit area, go to your food bank, wherever you are, donate a few dollars because it goes a long way. If you're in Michigan or northern Ohio, go to ForgottenHarvest.org. Every dollar you give, we feed 6 people, and the need is so great right now. There's so many people out of work.
And you feed how many in a year now? It's astonishing.
12.5 million meals we've almost completed this year. We're going to go to 14 million next year. And it's because of generous people in this part of the world that are helping us do this in even the worst economic times. We got Katrina every day here in Detroit, but people are stepping up. I'm seeing checks come in every day. I'm seeing checks come in off of the show, by the way. Keep it up. Send 10 bucks. Go to our website, www.forgottenharvest.org. Give us $5. Give us 10 bucks. If you can spare 25 or 100 bucks, 100 bucks feeds 600 people. And it's the best thing you can do. You feel good about it. You can see what we do, and I'll love you for it.
Cool. Thanks, Jason. And thanks all of you who tuned in today.
Thanks, Robin.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern
Get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutoLineDetroit.tv.